Open your Bibles, please, to Matthew chapter 20, verse 1. Years ago, having moved back to Reading from seminary, I needed a job. I was all educated up, and I didn't know how to do anything. And so I was actually really tired of being in a classroom for 7 years, and so I wanted to learn how to do something with my hands. And so I picked up an application to do for a construction job. And I got a call back, and they said to come in for an interview. So I walked into this trailer, and in this trailer was a man in a hard hat sitting behind this desk. And he went through the short interview, and long story short, I got the job. I ended up working for three and a half years doing framing here in Reading. But this man who was sitting on the other side of the desk, who would turn out to be my supervisor for the next 3 years, he looked across the desk at me. I'll never forget the last question of the interview. He looked over his really dark sunglasses at me where I was sitting, and he said this. He says, "How much would you like to be paid an hour?" And I hesitated because honestly, I didn't know that was an option for me to choose this. I didn't know what to say. Was this a test? Should I risk embarrassment and suggest a really high amount, you know, maybe impress him by my confidence? Or should I be humble and honest and give a really low amount, you know, closer to reality and hope, you know, maybe hope he offered more? What was I supposed to do? Well, in the end, I copped out, man. I didn't know what to do, which tactic was best. So I just said, "I don't know." I don't know. And I remember he just looked across the desk at me and said, "Son, a man should know what he's worth." Well, that felt great. Regardless of what you think about that, I think the lesson he was essentially trying to impress upon me was a good one. It was the importance of knowing what I was capable of and being realistic about what I could offer an employer. He was talking about the importance of knowing myself. But as important as that lesson was for my experience in the workforce, in our text today, I think there's a different lesson that Jesus is trying to impress upon Peter and upon the other apostles and upon us here as well through this parable that we're going to study. Because here in a parable about many other men who are being hired for a job, the lesson being taught is not so much the importance of knowing themselves. But no, I want to argue that the lesson being taught instead is the importance of knowing the master. And in particular, knowing this about him. In this parable, I believe Jesus is teaching us that God is a master who always does what is right. Well, before we jump in, how did we get here? How did we get to this parable that's known as the laborers in the vineyard? We got here because Peter heard Jesus say to a rich man who wanted to join them, Peter heard Jesus say, "Go, sell what you possess and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come follow me." Now, to be clear, Jesus doesn't say everyone who wishes to be his disciple must get rid of all their stuff. I think some of you have been worrying about that for 2 weeks now. Jesus never teaches it's more godly to be poor. And Jesus never teaches that money or personal property in itself is evil. Yes, there are many dangers that come with wealth, and there are many, many warnings in the Bible about that. But Jesus never teaches that possessions, however many or however few you have, are evil, or that everyone must give all that they have away. But he does command this particular rich man to do so. And he does this because it forces the man to admit that he's made money his God. It forces him to admit he can't earn eternal life by keeping the commandments, much less gain the rewards Jesus promised here if he'll give up his wealth, because he sees now he can't even keep the first commandment. And he sees now he hasn't even kept the last. The man is forced to admit all of this to himself in one devastating moment when Jesus says, "Go, sell what you possess and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven." and come follow me. But instead of admitting his fault and turning to Jesus for mercy, the man knows his fault and still turns away. Friends, don't turn away when Jesus confronts you with your sins. Turn to him for the mercy that he waits to give to you. Well, Peter hears this exchange, and he suddenly thinks, wait a minute, we've given up everything to follow Jesus. And we've done it for a while now, right? So if this man was promised treasure in heaven, if he gave up everything, what's in it for us? And so, pointing to the stark contrast between the failure of this rich man and the faithful response of the 12, Peter blurts out, "See, we've left everything and followed you. What then will we have?" Now, again, we're not talking here about doing good works to earn salvation. No, Jesus is clear. The whole Bible is clear. We're saved from sin only by turning away from hope in anything else and turning instead to Jesus. We're saved by putting our trust in Jesus and in his finished work for us alone. It's the only way we're saved. But the Bible does talk quite a bit about rewards. God's people are promised some earthly rewards in this life, but mostly treasures in heaven for losses that come as a result of faithful service for him here in this life. And so we said Peter's running the numbers when it comes to losses and rewards. He's running the numbers. And the conclusion he keeps coming to is the same every time. God must owe us, and owe us big. Let me put it this way. Peter would not have had a problem answering my interview question, because Peter is pretty sure he knows what he's worth. The problem is Peter's got his eyes on the wrong thing. The problem is Peter is trying to know the wrong thing, because he shouldn't be looking at himself, and he shouldn't be comparing himself to the rich man or to the other disciples either. Why? Because doing that, he's going to think he knows who should get what from God when it comes to rewards for services rendered. Except that last week, Jesus implied he couldn't know this. Instead, at the end, Jesus warned, "Many who are first will be last, and the last first." What Jesus seems to be saying is that if we focus on trying to know the wrong thing, it's going to steal our joy. Because apparently there'll be surprises when it comes to who gets what. Jesus seems to be saying that trying to know or calculate who gets what is just going to rob us of a proper attitude of gratitude, right? And so what's the alternative for Peter and for the disciples and for us? I think Jesus is saying the thing we should always be factoring in, the thing we should know instead, is the master, what he's like. And this in particular about the master, we should know that God is a master who always does what is right. That we can take confidence in that, that we can be sure of that, that we can focus on that. And to illustrate this, Jesus now tells them a parable. And I'm going to break this parable up into three parts that help us see three ways God does what is right. And so I'll walk us through each part, and then I'll explain how it illustrates God doing what is right in each part, and then I'll move on to the next part. And so look with me now at the first part that begins with verse 1. "For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard." Grapes were one of the most important crops in ancient Israel, and now a great many of them are ripe in this imaginary vineyard that Jesus speaks of. Who knows, maybe they were sitting there looking over a vineyard as Jesus spoke. And so instantly, as Jesus says these words about the harvest, the disciples picture the familiar scene. Harvest time in the countryside. They think of the heat of late summer. They imagine the sound of cicadas humming in the background. They picture the laborers moving up and down the rows with their knives and with their baskets. There's a smell when a field is ready to be harvested. I read in one magazine about grape farming. The air is crisp in the early morning. often laden with moisture. The berries glisten as the sun rises over the field, and the earth smells sweet and ripe and heavy. And so Jesus says that a master of a house, probably referring to a landowner or a homeowner, a farmer, all in one in those days, this man goes out early one crisp morning to hire day laborers to help harvest his vineyard. Now, these day laborers, these are men with no permanent employer so they rely on whatever jobs they can get on a day-to-day basis. You know, beggars can't be choosers. They're out there taking whatever job they can get. They need to support themselves and their family. They're hand to mouth, they're day-to-day surviving here. They have no nest egg, they have no safety net, they have no financial backup plan. These men are surviving day to day. And the master probably goes out early for two reasons. First, because there's a lot of work to be done. You want to start early. The vineyard must be a large one. And second, because he knows the day will soon grow hot and the workers will be more productive the longer they can work in the cool hours of the morning. We learn later that the place the master goes to hire these men is the marketplace. And we've noted before in Matthew's gospel, as we've gone through, other things have taken place in the marketplace. We've noted that this is like the town square for most towns. Goods of all kind are sold there. Sometimes trials are held there. Children play their games there. And those looking for work apparently also congregated there. When Esther and I were living in New York so I could go to seminary, I had just a bunch of part-time jobs that I squeezed around my classes, and one of those jobs was doing landscaping. And I worked for one or two people in particular, but one day as I went to a house where I worked each week, the owner of the house was waiting for me. He was sitting in his pickup truck. It was idling there, and he said, "Hop in. We're going to go hire some additional help for the work we've got going on today." And so we'd never done this before. I didn't know where we were going. So I hopped in, and we drove for a while until we got to this part of town I'd never been to before. And things were a little more run down, but there was this storefront, and there was this parking lot with a lot of potholes in it, and there was this big group of guys just kind of standing there. Some of them had tools, some of them didn't, but they were all just standing there, large group of Hispanic-looking men. They were waiting for work. And I'd never seen anything like this. I'd grown up in Africa and seen similar things, but never in the States. This was really weird for me. And it was a place that everybody seemed to know about and a place that people could go to if they needed extra laborers. And sure enough, the owner that I worked for, he pulled his truck up to a group of these guys and he rolled down his window and he said he needed five guys. So a bunch of guys are crowding around. They're like, "How much? You know, how much for the day?" He gave them a sum, and the first five guys who agreed, they jumped in the back of the truck, and that was that. We drove off to our project and got to know these day laborers. Well, this is the same thing that this landowner is doing. He rolls into the marketplace, and he sees a group of laborers waiting around, and he hires them all. Sounds like he hires them all. Look now at verse 2. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. Now, a workday in ancient Israel was typically divided into four parts that were 3 hours long each, running from approximately 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. In other words, it was a 12-hour workday. So you complain about your workday, but this is a 12-hour workday, and this is hard labor. And since these first workers are getting hired at the very beginning of the day, at 6 a.m., they're expecting full pay for a full day. You could say they know what they're worth. And so they're expecting a typical day's wage, which in those days was a denarius. If you figure something like $15.50 an hour, which is California minimum wage today, that denarius would equal something like $186 for the day. And so the master agrees to pay them this amount that they expect to be paid. But at some point, the master decides to go get more workers. After all, the harvest is plentiful and the workers are few. Or maybe, as I think Jesus is as I think Jesus is communicating in this parable, maybe the master repeatedly heads back to the marketplace for another reason. Maybe he keeps heading back not because of his needs, but because he knows their needs. In other words, I don't think the master really needed any more workers. It doesn't tell us that for sure. That's just my hunch. Instead, I believe it's out of compassion and a spirit of generosity for these day laborers that the master keeps going back, not just one time, but three more times. Look now at verses 3-7. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And he said to them, you go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you. So they went. So that's the first time the master comes back to the market. Now he goes three more times. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same thing. Verse 6, and about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, why do you stand here idle all day? They said to him, because no one has hired us. He said to them, you go into the vineyard too. Five times in total now, the landowner has gone to the marketplace to hire workers. And each time he hires all the workers who are there. The first time he goes is at 6 a.m. The second time he goes is at 9 a.m. The third time he goes is at noon. The fourth time is at 3 p.m. And then he goes one last time at the 11th hour, we're told. He goes at 5 p.m. when there's only 1 hour of work left to be done in the vineyard. And most translations have the word idle here to describe the workers who the master finds standing around the marketplace each time he goes. But that word has kind of more of a negative sense, I think, now than what the word in Greek is intending, which is, I think it's really just communicating that they're not working. Right? It just means they're standing there with no work to do. They would work if they could, but they got no work to do. It means they have no work. They have no way to feed themselves or their families. And so the master steps in. And look especially at this last group that are gathered in at the 11th hour. The master asks them not just why do you stand here with no work to do, but why do you stand here all day with no work to do? And what is their answer? Because no one has hired us, they say. And I think these words tell us these aren't lazy men who showed up too late to be hired, but that they're possibly the least desirable workers. No one would hire them. They're the least desirable workers, and so they've just been repeatedly, you know, this guy's not the only one coming for workers, but so they've been repeatedly passed over by other employers. And if that's the case, they're not just the last to get hired, but they're also like the last kid picked for the team. You know what I mean? They're that kind of last too. But the master hires them too. He said to them, you go into the vineyard too. I love that. The main thing I think Jesus wants all his disciples to learn through this parable is that God is a master who always does what is right. And the first way God does what is right, just like this earthly master, is that God governs all things right. God governs all things right. What I mean by that is this. When in history or in your life you're hired, when in history you're saved and then sent out to work for the Lord, as well as what your role is once you are sent out into God's vineyard. All of this is up to God and is ordered by God. First of all, God governs the when. God makes all things beautiful in his time. We're told in Acts 17:26 that he, God, made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. In other words, the times and places of every person ever born on earth were determined by God. He made no mistakes. No one has ever been born on the wrong continent or into the wrong family. No one has ever been born in the wrong century. In fact, no one's ever even been born a minute too early or a minute too late, contrary to what many mothers might feel. And in the same way that God governs where and when people are born, the Bible tells us that God also governs exactly where and when they're born again. Some come to faith sooner, some later, but all in His time, at just the right time, whether it's the third hour or the sixth hour or the ninth hour, God is a master who steps in to save those who cannot feed themselves, those who cannot save themselves, those who are His, those who are passed over. God is a master who steps in to save those who, according to Ephesians 2:10, are created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. And so the point is, so what if the master has hired Peter and the rest of the 12 first? So what if he's hired them in the earliest morning hours of his ministry on earth? The timing of their early calling is not something they can ultimately take any credit for any more than the timing of those who are called to follow Christ later. They can't take credit for when they were called into the vineyard. Think of Paul, who believed and was commissioned by Christ years after the 12 were. Think of the thief on the cross who was found by the master in the strangest of all marketplaces and never even made it to the vineyard. Think of James, Christ's own brother, who only believed and then threw himself into the work of the kingdom after the resurrection of Jesus. And now think even bigger. Think even broader. Think of where in history you came to faith and were sent out by Jesus. Will you take credit for that timing? Or on the other side of things, would you take the blame? Would you take the devaluation that Peter would like to put on you from where he stands in history, from where he stands in our story? Would you like to be looked down at for your late arrival to work in the Master's vineyard? Because talk about the 11th hour. I mean, I've been pretty late for some things. I was pretty late this morning. I've been pretty late for some things. But in comparison to Peter, you and I are getting to God's vineyard a couple thousand years after the harvest began. Or put yourself in Peter's shoes. Will you look down on the one who comes to faith years after you, decades from now? And assume a higher place for yourself because of how much longer and how much more you've done in God's vineyard? And speaking of the work one person does for God in comparison to another, speaking of the what now, speaking of the nature of the good works that have been prepared in advance for us to do in God's vineyard, that too is governed and ordered by God, not you. You can't take credit for the when, you can't take credit for the what. Would you have Peter laugh at your work as the church secretary? Would you have John look down his nose at your ministry of cleaning up after coffee hour? Would I have Paul hold up his world-changing ministry and compare it to the work that I do here at this church? Or on the other side of things, would you hold up your own work in God's vineyard and feel some glow of pride in comparison to the work of the saints in the chairs next to you, or in comparison to the saints who came before you, the saints from the past? Recently on Twitter, an evangelical pastor named Michael Clary spoke of a tendency he had to sort of make fun of many simple backwoods preachers, or many simple backwoods teachers and Christians from the past. He writes this: "But then it began to dawn on me. I was standing on the shoulders of giants. My grandfather was one of those country preachers," he writes. "My great-grandfather was the same way. He only received a third-grade education. He planted a church deep in the hills of West Virginia and built a church building for it on his own property. He stayed true to the Lord and to his calling for 80 years," he writes. "And here I was, 3 or 4 years into my new church plant, attracting a few hundred people, feeling like I'd accomplished something, feeling superior to men like my grandfather and great-grandfather. So I repented, he says. I repented of my arrogance. I repented of looking down on faithful older Christians who had passed on a legacy to me. The point is this: so what if the works the Master has called Peter and the rest of the 12 to are so much greater in so many ways to the work he's got us doing? And so what if the work God has prepared for you to do is so much greater, so much more impressive or more sophisticated in many ways to the work of someone else or to someone who has come before? The point is the same in every case. The point is that the work we do in the Master's vineyard is not something any of us can ultimately take credit for. No, it is God who governs all things right, the timing and the work. And so maybe Jesus found you in the marketplace early in the days of your life. Maybe he came to you in your middle years, in the strength of midday, as Barclay puts it. Or maybe he's only come to you now in your twilight years, at the 11th hour, when the shadows are lengthening. Whatever the case, you can trust that God has a purpose. You can trust that God has a work left for you still to do in his vineyard. You can trust him on this. And you can know that no one is able to look down at you either for your youth or for your age. No one can look down at you and claim to know the worth of the work that God has called you to do. Whether it looks like being a world changer or whether it looks like living a quiet life, minding your own affairs and working with your hands for his glory. Because whatever the hour or the task, my friend, you can trust that God is a master who always does what is right. He does what is right. Let's look now at verse 8 as we begin the second part of the parable. And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first." You know, what I love, first of all, about this is that even in his parables, Jesus is conscious of the law. Even in his parables. Because he's telling us, even by the timely payment of these workers, that this landowner is a just and fair master. He's telling us, he does what is right. This master, he does what is right. Leviticus 19:13 says that the wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning. And so right on cue, at the end of the workday, before it's night, the landowner gives the order for the workers to be paid. But now something else is confirmed about this landowner, I think. We see now what we suspected before, I believe. That he's not hiring in the same way or for the same reasons that the other landowners might hire. Because if he was, he probably wouldn't pay out the wages in the order that he does now. Beginning with the last up to the first. Why does he do this? This seems like he's asking for trouble. The point of doing this seems to have been to reveal or expose the attitudes and expectations of the workers, especially those who were hired first. And since Jesus is telling this parable to the 12, the point likewise seems to be that he's wanting to reveal and expose their attitudes and their expectations as well. Again, as those who've been hired first in some sense. So how does this reverse order payout function to reveal the attitudes and expectations of the listeners? Well, look now at verses 9 through 10. And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Verse 10. Now, when those hired first came, they thought what? They thought they would receive more. But each of them also received a denarius. Talk about asking for trouble. What has the landowner done? What has he done? What he's done is to expose the expectations of the workers hired first. And he's done this by making sure they see the workers hired last get paid the same amount they were promised at the beginning of the day. In other words, as the first workers are watching, they expect the last workers hired to only get a tiny fraction of a denarius, whatever that is. After all, they only worked for 1 hour. And so I guess in dollars, that they would have expected these last workers to get $15.50. They worked 1 hour. But instead, what does the landowner do? He gives them the full $146. The same amount owed to those who worked all 12 hours. Now, before we move on to the workers hired first, I just want you for a minute to imagine the shock and the joy of the workers hired last. Because speaking of expectations, they didn't expect this at all. I guarantee they did not expect this. No, unlike the first workers hired, they never agreed on a sum. Because they knew they were too late for negotiating. They knew they were at the mercy of the landowner. And so instead of fixating on what they might get paid, they were simply grateful they got hired at all. They simply thanked him for hiring them so late in the day, and they simply trusted him when he said, "Whatever is right, I will give you. Whatever is right, I will give you." But they never imagined he'd give them this. This is better than anything they could have hoped for. Because this wasn't just right, you know, giving them what was right, what was just baseline fair, would have been giving them $15.50. And so this was something far beyond right. And this kind of generosity, to me, confirms that this master hasn't hired all these workers in the first place because he needed them. I think he hires them because he knows they need him. His generosity here confirms to me his earlier motive of compassion, because generosity is something that naturally flows out of compassion. And this is a very generous man. Well, okay, so now you might also imagine, let's think of the other workers. Now you can probably imagine their initial reaction, their initial excitement first, right? Because at first, they were probably a little excited too. Because if you're them, what are you naturally thinking at this point? You watch the last workers of the day get paid what you were promised for a full day, and so you're thinking, wow. You're thinking, wow, if these guys who only worked 1 hour get paid a full day's wage, how much more will we get? This landowner owes us, and he owes us big. Or as Jesus put it, when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more, but what did they get instead? But each of them also received a denarius. You know, I think if we're honest at this point, we're left here, well, first of all, we feel bad for these guys, but we're left here to assume, first of all, that not only did those hired last and first receive a denarius, but also, I think all the workers, it's implied, all the workers hired at every other point during the day were given a denarius. We're left here to picture for ourselves the sinking realization of the first group of workers as every other group gets paid what they were promised. And instead of getting paid on some increasing scale, you can kind of sense these first workers, they got this sinking realization that they aren't going to receive more after all. But we're not left to imagine their final response to getting this denarius as promised. We see their response now in verses 11 through 13. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, verse 12, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." You know, how dare you? Verse 13. But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius?" So I think we have to be honest and admit we feel for these first laborers a little bit, right? Like a little bit. We're just like, ugh, that just doesn't sit right. Here I think we have to admit with them that this just doesn't seem what? Fair. That it doesn't seem just. And so here I think there's a vitally important principle that we all must understand, because it's a spiritual principle we find shot through every part of the Bible, and every part of the Christian experience. And that principle is this, that God is both just and God is non-just, but God is never unjust. God is never unjust. Here's what I mean. Picture this principle this way, or I've seen it pictured this way. I don't have a chalkboard, but R.C. Sproul used to draw a big circle. Imagine a big circle drawn on a chalkboard. And inside of that circle, he would write the word justice. Justice. And so he said to imagine that everything inside that circle was justice. And what is justice? Justice is getting what you're owed. Justice is getting what you're due. Justice is getting exactly what you deserve, no more, no less. And so Dr. Sproul would say to picture everything inside that circle is justice, first circle. And then next to that first circle, Dr. Sproul would draw a second circle of the same size, and he would call it non-justice. So you have one circle is justice, a second circle, non-justice. Everything which is not justice equals non-justice. And so you have a circle representing justice, and you have a second circle representing non-justice. But then Dr. Sproul would point out that there's more than one kind of non-justice. Isn't there? There's more than one kind of non-justice. And to illustrate this, he would then cut the circle of non-justice in half with a line of chalk. He would bisect that circle, and inside the top half of the non-justice circle, he would write the word injustice. Right? That falls into the category of non-justice. He would write injustice on the top half of that second circle. And then inside the bottom half of the non-justice circle, he would write the word mercy or grace, because that is also non-justice. Mercy or grace. And so there are two kinds of non-justice. There is injustice and there is mercy. And after drawing this picture, he would point to it and say what I just said just a moment ago, that God is both just and God is non-just, but God is never unjust. So that what he meant is that what God gives to people is always one of two right things. He either gives a person justice or he gives a person mercy. He either gives a person exactly what they deserve or he gives a person something good they don't deserve at his expense. He either gives to a person out of the circle marked justice or he gives to a person out of the top half of the non-justice circle marked grace. But God never, ever gives anyone injustice. Now, the main thing Jesus wants all his disciples to learn through this parable is that God is a master who always does what is right. The first way God does what is right, we said, is that God governs all things right. And now the second way God does what is right is that God gives what is right. And that means God never gives anything less than justice. God gives what is right. And so does this earthly master in this parable. He's given all the laborers what is right. He's either given them exactly what they do deserve, or he's given them something more, something good that they don't deserve at his own expense. So that even though some of them may think they've been cheated and grumble, even though some of them feel like they've received injustice, the truth is that this master has not broken his word. He has given them what they're due. No, he's given them what is fair and right because at the very least, he's given them exactly the amount they agreed to from the beginning. And so he says to one of them, friend, he says, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? And you'll notice the person doesn't answer the master. He doesn't answer because he can't answer back to the master any more than we can answer back to God when we feel like he's being unfair. Any more than we can answer back to God when we think that he's being unjust. Because the answer in both cases is at worst, yes. Yes, it's true. You, God, you have given me exactly what I was owed. And that is justice. that is right. God is a master who always does what is right. Let's look now at verses 14 through 16 as we start into the third part of the parable. He replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius?" Verse 14, "Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I gave to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity?" Verse 16, "So the last will be first, and the first last." So here we have this master. He's already shown that no injustice was done to those first workers. So now in verses 14 and 15, he shows that so long as justice has been done to everyone, it's completely up to him if he wants to do anything more in addition to justice. Right? He shows that so long as he's just towards all, he's also free to be generous to some, to show grace to some. And so verse 15 begins with these words, "Am I not allowed?" which could also be translated, is it not lawful for me? So the master is saying to this first group of workers, isn't it legal? Right? Isn't it legal for me to give good gifts to who I want? Yes. Right? It's a rhetorical question. In other words, having proved they can't be angry at him for injustice, he's now turning the tables on them. Are you doing what is right? He's now asking. You know, they're coming to him. You're not doing what is right. Now he turns to them. Are you doing what is right? Are you doing what is right? Is it really okay to be angry at someone for their generosity to someone else? Doesn't that reveal something more about us? Is that really even any of our business? And just like this earthly master, God is a master who is free to choose which right thing he wants to do with what belongs to him. Which means he can choose to justly give, or he can choose to graciously give. He can justly give or he can graciously give to give something more at his own expense. He can choose to do either. But in either case, whatever God gives is always right. It's always right. But I think the third thing Jesus wants all the disciples to see from Peter to you and I is that none of us who trust in him are actually in that first group of workers who get justice. We're not even in that first group. Why? Why would I say that? Because none of us have received what we're due. Not a one. Not a one who are believers in Jesus have ever received what they're due. Remember, friends, that the justice all people are due, according to the Bible, is the judgment and wrath of God for sin. That is what you are due. That is what you are due. We've all sinned against God, and the Bible says the wages of sin is death. That's the paycheck God owes every human being, physical death and the fires of hell. But God, in his compassion and love, freely chose to show mercy to some and sent Jesus to rescue his people from their sin. That's what the Bible teaches. And to do this, Jesus worked himself to death. From the dawn of his birth, through the heat of midday, all the way to the last light of Good Friday, Jesus bore the burden of his people's workday for them. Amen. He toiled in the vineyard of God's law, and he plucked every grape, and it was sweet wine and a delight to the master. And then on a cross, he took the sin of his people and the wages it deserved, and he gave to them. He gave to us who put our trust in them. He gave to them in exchange all the wages he'd earned. He took the justice so his people could receive good gifts. And then Jesus rose from the dead, proving that justice was satisfied. Jesus rose from the dead, proving that his people never again needed to fear the wages of sin, but should always thrill instead in the good gifts of grace that we've been given. And if you will admit to him your need for saving today and put your trust in this same Jesus, those gifts will be yours as well. The gifts of grace. And in the same way, Jesus wants his disciples to see they're part of the last group too. They're not part of this first group, because the fact of the matter is, no disciple of Jesus is getting what they deserve. The fact of the matter is, all of us who are hired and sent out into the master's vineyards have come too late to negotiate. We've got no leverage. We've got nothing to negotiate with. We've all come late into the vineyard, every one of us. None of us comes with any leverage. None of us comes with any contract that we can hold God to. We come with any rights we can hold God to. No, all of us who are called out of the marketplace of death into a meaningful life, into meaningful kingdom work, we have been called by the mercy of the Master. Every one of us. The disciples need to know this, and we need to know this. All we've ever received from him, from first to last, is the greatest mercy, the greatest grace. God can choose to justly give, and he can choose to graciously give. And I think the third thing Jesus wants all his disciples to see is that we are of the group to whom God graciously gives what is right. Always. Always. In other words, from our salvation all the way to our rewards that may come to us for our work, God is always choosing to give us, to give you, to give me what is non-just. He's always giving us more than fair, far more than fair. His choices of what we'll receive are always generous, gracious choices. And since we've talked so much about rewards, let me just touch on those briefly, right? Because yes, the Bible teaches there will be rewards given to God's people on top of the gift of salvation. But again, even those rewards, I mean, we need to be humbled by this. I think Jesus is trying to humble us a little bit, along with Peter here. We need to remember that even those gifts will ultimately be unmerited. Even those gifts, those rewards that we get in heaven are gifts of grace. They're gifts of grace. God crowns not our merits. He doesn't reward our merits, says Calvin, but his own gifts. He's rewarding the gifts he gave to us first. I want you to think about that. Here's a way to think about it. A friend of mine talks about going to a Christmas party. I may have told this before. He went to a Christmas party, and he got a gift from a family that he had actually given to them years before. And they didn't realize it, and he didn't tell them. But that's a perfect example of every good thing you've ever given to God. That's a perfect example of everything you've given up or given, everything you think you've sacrificed to God, because here you are, busy sacrificing your best for him, and it's him who gave you those things in the first place. And yet he still will reward you for it. That's grace. That's pretty amazing. Or think of the story of the wedding at Cana. You know, that's the one where the wine ran out, right? You think of that story. Think of how all the bridegroom of the feast had to offer at that point was what? Water. All he had was water. But what does Jesus do? Jesus changes that water into wine. And not only, I missed this for a long time. Not only does he change the water into wine, Jesus lets the bridegroom get the credit when he brings the wine out to the master of the feast. And that's exactly the way our rewards will work too. Jesus turns the water of our works, the pitiful works of our lives, the best we can do. Jesus takes that water and he turns it into wine, the best wine. And then God, the master of the vineyard and the master of the wedding feast, he tastes it and he smiles at you kindly and he says, well done. Well done. Friends, that is grace. Every crown you earn is a reward, as a gift from God, which is why I think that's why we'll cast them back down before him when we get to heaven. And so if we don't even have a right to be angry at God when he gives justice, how much less do we have a right to be angry at God for doing what is gracious towards a fellow disciple? No, Jesus is saying to Peter and to us, there's no room for a disciple to be jealous of the good gifts God gives to another disciple. If you're angry or you're jealous about that, are you doing what is right? Are you doing what is right? Is it really even any of your business what God gives to another disciple? God is a master who always does what is right. Friends, casting an accusing eye at heaven or a jealous eye at our fellow disciple takes our eye off the master. Trying to know or calculate who will receive more of a gracious gift only misses the point. That's an attitude that will only rob us of the wonder and the gratitude and the joy of being among those who've been sought out by a gracious God. Because the whole point is, no matter what Christians get what, it's all grace. From the first to the last, it's all grace.